Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. As the year draws to a close, you may have a few questions about the 2012 tax code and decisions you may want to make before the 31st about whether certain financial transactions may be taxable, about charitable giving, about how changes in your income or assets this year compared to past years may ultimately affect the taxes that you pay next spring. Never fear, Focus is here to provide some guidance. On today's program, we welcome your year-end tax questions for our guests from McGladrey LLP in Champaign, CPA and partner Marty Verdick and Tax Director John Breen. Marty, John, welcome to Focus.
Thanks. Good to be back.
Glad to have you with us. And Marty and John can help us walk through any changes in the tax code from last year, what may be in store in the coming year, and that's a big question, and whatever else you may need to know in order to make informed decisions in the coming days that may impact your taxes come April. As we begin our conversation, we welcome your tax questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also reach out to us on Facebook at Will Radio TV Online, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. The phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Marty, what are some basic decisions to make or actions we may need to consider taking over the next 10 days that might impact our 2012 taxes?
Well, there are several things to consider. There are some known changes that are going to occur starting next year. There are some unknowns for any of us that have been following the news in Washington, there's a lot of unknown out there. But one known thing that we have for higher income taxpayers, joint returns over $250,000, investment income, such as capital gains, interest, dividends, and several other types, will be subject to a 3.8% health care reform surtax. So one of the things that I've had clients do is consider accelerating some capital gains this year, actually triggering some sale of stock before the end of the year to capture the gain this year when we have a 15% maximum rate of tax on the capital gain and we avoid the 3.8% surtax that would have otherwise applied next year. If capital gain rates go up, as many of us expect they will, that could result in a fairly significant tax savings when compared to a sale that might have otherwise occurred next year. So the normal strategy of deferring income and accelerating deductions may not apply this year, depending upon the nature of the income. And we've been involved with some of those kinds of things. The whole planning around this health care reform surtax is a big issue for people. It will affect taxpayers, joint taxpayers over $250,000 of income, single over $200,000, and it will result in an increased rate of tax on a lot of types of income they might not think of as investment income, such as rental income would be subject to that.
Let's back up a little bit in terms of terminology, because there are a few terms you threw out there which I think some people that are really engaged in their finances understand, and some others maybe not so much. Mm-hmm. Let's start with capital gains. And John, what are capital gains?
Well, typically, you know, the most common example would be stocks that you would sell. Those are subject to capital gain rates. As opposed to certain types of business property that you might sell, you know, some of those things can be taxed at an ordinary rate of income.
The advantage of capital gains, and let's make a distinction between short-term and long-term capital gains. A long-term capital gain is a gain from the sale of an investment asset like a stock or a mutual fund that has a holding period in excess of 1 year. The advantage of that is under current tax law, there is a maximum rate of tax of 15% federal that applies to that rather than being taxed at your ordinary marginal rate, which currently could be as high as 35%. Now, capital gains can also result from the sale of collectibles, such as artwork or some of those kinds of things. But the typical capital gain would be mutual funds and stocks and so on. And it's long-term capital gains that we're talking about here, those held for more than a year.
Okay. And so the concern is that the rates at which those would be taxed would go up in the coming year?
That's correct. If Congress takes no action, the rate of tax on long-term capital gains will go up January 1st to a 20% rate rather than our current 15%. In addition, for higher income taxpayers, that capital gain would be subject to an additional 3.8% tax, which is the health care reform surtax. It's used to pay for health care reform that was passed a couple of years ago.
All right. You're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guests are accountants Marty Verdick and John Breen from McGladrey LLC in Champaign. Or sorry, LLP.
LLP.
I don't know how I got the C on there. Sorry about that. They are here to field your end of the calendar year tax questions, and we welcome anything you would want to ask a CPA about your taxes, and in particular, decisions you may want to make in the next 10 days that could affect the taxes you pay in April. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Or as always, you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we will begin this morning with Kathy in Champaign. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. My question is with respect to a refund of medical insurance premiums, which I received this year. And I'd like to know whether I would declare that as income on Form 1040, presumably on the line other, or if I would calculate it into the amount I would include on my Schedule A medical deductions as an offset of the amount, total amount of medical expenses paid out.
Okay. Kathy, let me ask a question. What year did the medical when did you pay the medical expenses that gave rise to the refund? Were those paid in 2012 or in a prior year?
Prior year.
Okay. So you claimed you had medical expenses, let's say, in 2011. Were you able to itemize deductions and obtain a tax benefit from those medical expenses?
In 2011.
Yes. You did. Okay. Then under the tax benefit rule, what would happen is that to the extent that you did receive a tax benefit in a prior year from those medical expenses, and now you've received a refund from your insurance company in a subsequent tax year, that would be included as other income on the first page of your tax return. But only to the extent that you received a tax benefit. I mean, if you let's say your refund this year is $5,000 and you only received a benefit from $3,000 of deductions last year, you would only have to report the amount to the extent that you received a deduction benefit.
Okay, so for example, if I received a medical refund, if I had medical expenses that were declarable on Schedule A of $2,000, and I received a refund check this year of $1,000 for my medical insurance premium, would I just declare
the one thousand? Yeah, if you got a refund of $1,000,
I got a refund of the refund. The insurance premium refund was for $100.
Oh, I thought you said $1,000. Then it would just be the $100. And remember, when we talk about tax benefit, medical expenses are limited in their deductibility. They have to exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. So it's only if the medical expenses in 2011 exceeded that limit and you actually got the benefit of a deduction that you would have to report that as income this year, but only to the extent that you got a refund.
Only to the extent that I get a refund.
Right. So if you got a refund of $100, that's the maximum amount you would have to report as income. Okay?
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Right. You're welcome.
Thanks very much for the call.
Okay.
And you're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guests, accountants Marty Verdick and John Breen from McGladrey LLP in Champaign. They are here to field your tax questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. This is the time of year, gentlemen, when a lot of people come to that conclusion about what sort of charitable giving they want to do over the course, you know, for that given calendar year. And that, of course, always has tax implications if it's something that's deductible. Is that something that could potentially change in the coming year?
Currently there are no scheduled changes to the deductibility for charitable contributions. There is a change that is going to happen that will affect potentially itemized deductions in general. And remember, to receive a tax benefit from a charitable contribution, you have to actually be able to itemize your deductions as opposed to claiming the standard deduction. For a number of years, there was a phase out of itemized deductions based on a person's level of income. And the more income you make, the greater that phase out of itemized deductions. That has disappeared for the last few years, and it is scheduled to come back January 1st. However, the way the phase out works would not result in a proportionate disallowance of deductions. So as long as you have enough total itemized deductions to exceed the phase out, any additional deductions, you still get the full benefit from. Now, this is certainly the time of the year that people should be considering any year-end giving. As they look at their tax situation, that is a deduction which is easily controllable by people. They can write that check before the end of the year and claim the deduction. But one thing we always encourage people to do is look at the bigger picture, and if they have assets that have appreciated in value, and I'll use an example of stock. Let's say someone has some stock that they paid $100 a share for, and it's now worth $250 a share. Rather than writing a check to the charity, they could give the stock or other assets to the charity and get a full deduction for the fair market value and not have to pay tax on the gain that they otherwise would have paid. So for taxpayers who have investment portfolios or appreciated assets, making a gift of that asset is actually quite a bit more tax efficient than just making a gift of by check or cash. And we certainly encourage people to look at that, especially for the larger gifts.
Let's take another call. We have Don on the line from LaSalle. Don, good morning.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I wanted to know how much depreciation a person can take off in 1 year.
Okay, so are you talking about a depreciation deduction or the Section 179 deduction where you can expense property in a given year?
Well, like 2 years ago, I bought a tractor for $22,000, and I could deduct the whole thing off in 1 year.
Right. That's what's called the Section 179 deduction, where in essence what you get to do is you get to elect to expense that property in the current year.
Okay.
Now, the rule for 2012 is it's $139,000. But one other thing to keep in mind is that we still have bonus depreciation for 2012 as well. And so what bonus does is if you don't make this election to use the Section 179, you get to write off half of the value of the asset in the current year, and then you depreciate the remainder. Now, one thing to keep in mind is this has to be new property as opposed to used. With the Section 179, you know, you don't have that same parameter. You can use that on used property as long as it's not property that you or a relative were using previously.
What I was wondering is this year I bought a brand new truck.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if I could deduct the whole thing off this year.
Yeah, it depends on the type of truck. There are certain rules as far as as what you can write off in terms of what's the gross vehicle weight of the truck, how long is the bed. I mean, there are several different items that you have to go through to determine, does this qualify for being able to use all of it for Section 179, or is it going to be limited because it's what we call listed property, which is what most automobiles fall into.
If this is the answer would be different if we're talking about a pickup truck versus a grain truck, for example.
Okay.
And if it's a standard pickup truck, there are going to be potentially some limits on the amount that you would not be able to necessarily write off the entire cost in the first year. But that's something you'd have to know more about the particulars of that vehicle to be able to tell you with certainty what the answer is.
Well, how much could a person deduct the first year?
Well, again, it depends on the nature of the truck.
Depends on the nature of the truck.
Right. The gross vehicle weight, bed length, those kinds of things. There are some special rules for certain types of larger trucks that allow you to write off all of it, but if it's just a standard pickup truck, you're going to be limited in the first year.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know.
Yep.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're taking your tax questions for Marty Verdick and John Breen from the accounting firm of McGladrey LLP in Champaign. You can call us this morning at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Next up is Susan in Urbana. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I just wanted to say with regard to donating appreciated mutual funds or securities, it's a little complicated, and it takes a while. So trying to do it now with the holidays coming up and get it accomplished so that it counts for this tax year is something I gave up on, actually, yesterday.
Well, you're exactly right. It's not as simple as writing a check and putting it in the mail. It requires coordination between the broker that handles the account and so on, and you know, different brokerage firms will have different lead times on this, and there's no question that you're coming right up to the end of the last possible moment. It's sort of like mailing your Christmas cards today. You're right up against the edge. But you're exactly right. It's certainly more complicated than putting a check in the mail.
And having not done it before, I didn't realize what all was involved. I was going to try you. We have mutual funds with Vanguard. Mm-hmm. And while you can get the forms online and print them out online, you have to physically mail them in. You can't send the scans in. And some things require additional signatures. For instance, to give to the UI Foundation, I would have had to get a form, a Vanguard form, filled out and signed by the UI Foundation as to who was supposed to receive the money.
Sure, because Vanguard has to know where it goes.
Right. Also have to. It's security to make sure you don't have somebody stealing your money.
Right.
And I appreciate that, but I'm just giving people a heads up. And if you'd had this program a month ago, I might have gotten my act together.
Might have gotten it done.
Yeah. Well, at least I treated it as a learning experience. Yeah. I now know where the forms are. But just as a heads up for people, it's probably not worth your trying to do. Right,
well, it certainly with respect to mutual funds, it's more difficult. If you're talking about individual securities and you're dealing with a local broker where you can literally just walk in and sign the paperwork, it's a little easier to accomplish.
I must say that I got very good help from Vanguard staff, and I moved a tax-sheltered annuity from when I worked at a small nonprofit over to Vanguard, and they got on a conference call with me with Mass Mutual and helped me figure out what I needed to do. And I just thought that was very helpful. And there are resources; it just takes time.
Right.
Thanks.
Yep.
Thank you for the call. We were talking, John, before about the notion of whether or not to itemize or take the standard deduction. And mm-hmm. I wanted to ask this is a general philosophical question. Does it make sense in our tax code that we have something called a standard deduction?
Well, I don't know from the standpoint of whether it makes sense. It's kind of been something that's been built in, you know, for a number of years. I mean, certainly as long as Marty and I have been doing this, we've had a standard deduction, you know, versus itemizing deductions. You know, the thing about itemization is those things have changed over the years as well. I mean, there was a period of time where you could actually deduct credit card interest as part of your itemization, and they no longer allow that and haven't allowed it for a number of years. So I think, you know, what it really does is there are certain things that are incented by being able to itemize, like the mortgage interest deduction, you know, the property taxes, the charitable. There are certain things that are going to allow you to deduct those things. And I think what the intent was is that for those people who don't have those type of deductions, that they have kind of a floor that they're allowed to use, you know, if they're not going to have enough other deductions to get them there.
Marty, are there other things that are up in the air about our taxes for this current tax year, never mind 2013, 2014 and beyond? What else is out there that we should be
wondering about? How much time do you have?
We have 30 minutes. Go for it.
There are a lot of things, and that is what makes this year-end so unique, is that it's very difficult to do planning because we don't know. For example, in the estate and gift area, an individual currently has an estate and gift tax exemption, a lifetime exemption of $5,120,000. If Congress takes no action, that will go to $1 million January 1st. So many wealthy clients, taxpayers, are considering and are in the process of making large gifts to their children or other recipients of their generosity before the end of the year to capture that gift exemption this year rather than allowing it to revert back to a $1 million amount next year. That transaction alone can result in potentially a couple of $1 million of savings upon their death. So for older, very wealthy taxpayers, that's certainly a very good planning strategy. Now, Congress may render all of that meaningless if, in fact, they extend this $5 million exemption into the future years. So, I mean, these are very, very large decisions that people are having to make with very limited information. There are a lot of other areas in the income tax regime that have the same kind of issue. We just don't know. And these issues like what's going to be the rate of tax on capital gains, what's going to be the maximum rate of tax on dividends, there are a lot of decisions that are just unknown. There are also a lot of things that are expiring next year that you really can't plan your way around, but could have very, very significant impact on people. Things like there are some family credits, the dependent care credit, the child credit, that would either be reduced or eliminated if Congress doesn't take action. And these are the kinds of things that are going to have a very significant impact on lower and middle class taxpayers as well as the wealthy. These are things that aren't targeted at the wealthy. Everyone is going to suffer from this. I mean, my daughter and her husband with two young children will stand to pay several thousand dollars more in tax next year as a result of the changes that are scheduled to occur. And, I mean, they certainly aren't wealthy people, but it will hit them.
But we also don't know that those will necessarily occur.
Absolutely. That's what, assuming if Congress takes no action, all of these things are going to happen. And so this is all part of this fiscal cliff negotiation in Washington that's currently the subject of so much airtime. We just don't know what they're going to do. And every day that passes, especially with the holidays coming up, makes it less and less likely that they're going to get something done before the end of the year. And then the possibility exists, of course, that they could make some retroactive changes in January. But again, it's very unfair to taxpayers to ask them to do any meaningful planning with all of the uncertainty that's out there.
I wonder also, John, if this means also a mad scramble for accountants when the new year rolls around. One way or another, hopefully eventually you'll know kind of what the tax code will look like. But is it going to make things a more hectic experience for you? And then also for anybody that's doing taxes themselves.
Well, I think the interesting thing, you know, for us has been our December has probably been more busy, you know, than it's been for a number of years. I mean, typically we do a lot of year-end planning. I think this year we're doing even more just because people, you know, they don't know. And when we advise them, we kind of have to tell them, well, okay, if nothing is done, here's what happens. But at the same time, you have to kind of talk about, well, here's some things that people have proposed. You know, you need to factor that into making your decision. I think, you know, January for us is going to be more around the payroll issue.
Right.
Because we're going to have a lot of, you know, what's going to happen to the payroll rates? Are they going to immediately go up? Are they, you know, going to keep them the same for a little while, you know, and then raise them? I think you have a lot of issues there. And certainly anybody doing their own return, January and February is going to be a very interesting time.
When you're talking about payroll rates, are you talking about the rates themselves or how much will be withheld from paychecks? Withholding,
well, yes.
just in case, you know, just anticipating.
Well, and there is a FICA tax rate that has been 6.2%, but for the last 2 years, we've had a 2 percentage point reduction in the FICA tax rate for individuals.
And remind everybody, what is FICA?
That's the Social Security withholding.
Okay.
That is scheduled to go back up to 6.2% January 1st if Congress doesn't extend it. The other thing that will occur during tax season, the longer Congress waits to take action, the more compressed the tax filing season is going to be because the IRS has already said once Congress changes the tax law, they've got to reprogram all of their software, as do all of the vendors that write the software programs that we use, and it will cause a delayed start in the tax season. But there's no change in the deadline, so it's going to cause a compression of the filing season.
Let's take some more calls. We'll go next to Jeff in Champaign. Hi, Jeff. Jeff, are you with us? Nope. Okay. Nobody there. We'll go to Ann on a cell phone. Hi, Ann.
Hi there. I wanted to know if you could talk to me about filing jointly versus filing separately. And we have one child, a 17-year-old dependent.
Sure.
And I was considering filing separately this year, and how would that work with that dependent?
Okay. Let me start by just an explanation of the difference for the benefit of the other listeners. As a married individual, you have two filing status choices, married filing jointly or married filing separately. Normally, for most taxpayers, married filing jointly, at least through the end of 2012, will result in a more favorable overall tax calculation. There are some exceptions if you, for example, if one spouse has extraordinary medical expenses. There are a few times when married filing separately can be to your benefit. What we do, our software automatically will calculate it and give us a warning diagnostic that says, hey, take a look at married filing separately. It may save tax. That's paraphrasing what it says. But the only way that you can know for sure is actually do your calculation, your return calculation, both ways. It's the only way to know for sure. As I say, the default, I would say, is that in most cases, It will result in a more favorable overall tax result by filing jointly. Now, one of the things that is scheduled to expire as of December 31st, there's something that's been known as the marriage penalty tax. It's not really a tax, but the way the rates worked, there actually could be a detriment to married filing jointly taxpayers if both spouses had about the same level of income. Well, they put a temporary correction in a few years ago to fix that. That is something else that's scheduled to expire December 31st. So we expect to see more taxpayers benefit from separate filing status next year when compared to this year. So there's no one-size-fits-all answer here. The only way to know for sure is to really do the calculation both ways.
And in regard to the dependent, who, like, we're actually considering, we're separated, mm-hmm. so we're considering filing separately for that reason.
Okay, yep, that would be a non-tax reason to do it.
Right. I mean, we just arm wrestle over who gets to take the deduction?
If you're just legally separated, not divorced at this point, there's been no legal determination of dependency, so generally it's going to boil down to who provides more of the support. If the child is residing primarily with one parent, typically that parent would be providing more of the support, and they would be the one to claim the exemption.
But only one of us can claim that.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And you can't cut them in half and each claim half either.
Okay.
It's one or the other.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Gary in Urbana. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi, good morning. The trickiest thing for me with income tax is making sure I paid enough, you know, up front so there's no penalty. I wanted to just make sure that, is it true that as long as you've paid as much as your previous year's total federal taxes, that there cannot be any penalty even if you've underpaid the current year?
Well, yes and no. It depends on what your adjusted gross income is. If your adjusted gross income is less than $150,000, then that is a true statement. As long as you pay in on at least a quarterly basis, you know, that amount that matches last year's tax liability or more, you cannot be penalized. However, if your AGI is over $150,000, then that calculation is based on 110% of the prior year tax.
Okay.
And the state.
Now, when you say in a quarterly amount, what if you haven't paid anything or you've underpaid during the year and can you make one big payment, you know, right now that would suffice to get you prevent the penalty?
Not on an estimated tax basis. The only way that could really happen would be with withholding, because withholding is assumed to be paid in throughout the year.
Right.
If you were supposed to make quarterly estimates and you missed the first three, then you're going to have some penalty for those first three quarters, even though you pay enough with the fourth quarter to meet that exception.
Yeah. Okay.
It's a quarterly calculation, and the reason they do that is to prevent taxpayers from just loading up all of their tax payment at the end of the year. The government wants to be paid on an ongoing basis, and the same rule applies to the state of Illinois, except the test applies, it's always 100% for the state of Illinois.
I would 100%.
Yeah, and I would also say that the penalty for federal purposes is a relatively low rate calculated like interest. The penalty for the state of Illinois is much higher. It's more like a credit card rate. So to the extent that you have to make a choice between paying one or the other, the state of Illinois has a much higher penalty rate.
Okay, but the best thing to do at this point is to at least, even if I haven't kept up monthly, let's say, or quarterly, is to at least have paid what I paid last year in taxes and put that in a fourth quarterly payment for this month. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, that would at least get you out of paying a penalty for the fourth quarter. And remember that payment is not due until January 15th.
Oh, okay.
So you have, you know, a 15-day grace period after the end of the year to calculate this and get it paid in.
Yeah, and I need to use a fourth quarterly form for that, which I can get on the online, I guess.
That's correct. It should be at irs.gov. And then if you need to pay the state of Illinois, Illinois has a website that you could print one of those out as well.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. We are talking with John Breen and Marty Verdick from Gladry LLP in Champaign. They typically join us around this time of year, again in late March or early April. That's when we do shows about taxes and field your tax questions. Some of the decisions that you make about your finances in the next 10 days could impact the taxes that you will pay in April. And particularly in light of uncertainty over next year's tax code, you may be inclined to make some decisions now or at least get some questions answered now. And you can do that by calling 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone numbers again, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. And we'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
The new season of HBO's series Enlightened begins in January. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the creator and co-star, Mike White. It stars Laura Dern as a corporate executive who, after a public meltdown, goes to a holistic meditative retreat. When she returns to work, she tries and usually fails to keep her sense of inner calm. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and at 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the Subaru Impreza, with standard all-wheel drive and an EPA highway rating of 36 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at SubaruofChampaign.com or at their location on Route 45 in Savoy.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're taking your tax questions today for Marty Verdick and John Breen from the accounting firm of McGladry LLP in Champaign. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Next up is Jeff in Champaign. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I had a question. I heard a strategy some time ago with regards to itemized deductions versus standard deductions, and I've never done this, but it sounded interesting. The suggestion was that you prepay your property taxes for the following year, and as you pay 2 years in one period, and that would bump up your deductions, and then the following year take a standard deduction. Doesn't seem quite kosher to me, but I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that strategy.
Well, actually, it's a very good planning strategy for some taxpayers, and it works very well. Let me explain how this works. The standard deduction, and I'll just assume a joint taxpayer for a moment, the standard deduction is $11,900. Let's assume that in a normal year, just paying your regular real estate taxes and making your charitable contributions and paying your mortgage, that your total itemized deductions come up to $12,000 even. So you have a choice of claiming your $12,000 standard deduction, $12,000 itemized deduction, or alternatively, your standard deduction will be $11,900. So by bunching your deductions, so let's say in the first year you prepay your real estate taxes and prepay all of your charitable contributions, and now suddenly your total itemized deductions, instead of being $12,000, maybe it's $17,000. You claim the itemized deductions for $17,000. The next year, you don't have any charitable contributions, you don't have real estate taxes, and so you simply take the standard deduction of $11,900. Over the course of the 2 years, the sum of the two is greater than had you just itemized each of those years.
Yeah, that's the situation I was in. Is that my standard deductions are about at the threshold.
That is a very appropriate planning strategy.
Okay, to do that, then.
Absolutely. And what you do is you go to the courthouse and you'll prepay your taxes, your real estate taxes, based on the prior year tax bill. And it works in Illinois because we pay our taxes in Illinois in arrears. So the taxes that you would normally pay in June of 2013 are for the 2012 tax year. So they are you've already incurred that liability, so it's okay to prepay it.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
All right, and our next call is from Kyle. Kyle, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. So I had a question about independent contractor work. I do some freelance writing, and in the past recent years, it's been a relatively nominal amount. But this past year, there's been a more on a monthly contract, and I was just curious as to what the upper limit is for before one has to start doing the estimated quarterly taxes.
John?
Well, as far as how that goes, I mean, it's going to depend on your personal situation. I mean, do you also have W-2 income in addition to this?
Yeah.
Okay. So really, it's going to depend on when that your self-employment income rises to a level where your withholding does not cover it.
Okay.
Now what some people will do is they'll say, well, gee, I really don't like making estimated payments. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just over withhold, you know, with my employer, you know, based on what the tables would normally tell me. And then that way you can sometimes, you know, cover the self-employment income through that extra withholding.
Okay, good. That's what I have been doing, and I figured that that would probably work, but I'm glad to hear that I may be right about that.
Yep, you're good to go.
All right, thanks for the call. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and there is still time for your tax questions for Marty Verdick and John Breen from McGladrey LLP in Champaign at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Phone numbers again, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. One of the things we wanted to talk a little bit about was the required minimum, is this income distribution?
Required minimum distribution.
Distribution.
Craig, what that is, for those taxpayers who are approaching or have reached age 70 and a half during this tax year, and you have qualified retirement plans, either pension plans, 401ks, IRA accounts, the IRS requires that you begin taking out a distribution from those plans either in the tax year that you reach age 70 and a half or by April 1st of the following year. They won't allow taxpayers to just let that money sit in the retirement plan forever. It's called a required minimum distribution. It's calculated based on the age of the taxpayer and the balance in the account. The reason I wanted to mention it is that there is a significant penalty that is imposed on taxpayers who fail to take that required minimum distribution. So, you know, here we are nearing the end of the year, and for any listener who has reached age 70 and a half this year and is in a situation where they have a retirement plan and have not started taking out distributions, they need to contact the plan administrator right away and make sure they get that distribution before the end of the year or at the very least by April 1st of next year to avoid the possible penalty that would apply.
Let's go next to Rich in Champaign. Hi, Rich.
Hello, yes. So I received a settlement from a bad investment that I made that was a broker who was bad anyway. So I received a settlement on that less than what my original investment was. How would that be treated?
So to make sure I understand, you invested money with a broker, and that broker invested the money in something, whether it's be stocks or they made some type of investment on your behalf.
Well, actually, it was a criminal case. So they actually went to jail, and I received a check from the attorney general from the state of New York.
Okay. There are some fairly unique rules, and I'm not going to be able to answer this in detail, but because it was a criminal case, it is possible that the initial loss, as opposed to being a capital loss, may in fact be treated as a theft loss, which could get you to a different tax result. Now, the settlement that you received, the nature of that settlement will depend on the nature of the investment originally. It will probably be, and John, I haven't run into one of these in a long time, but I think the settlement would probably be treated as capital gain. But that's a question that I would not be comfortable giving you a firm answer without looking at it a little bit just to make sure. And the reason it's unique is because it was a criminal case and someone went to jail over it, there are different results that you can get to as other than just it being a bad investment with a partial recovery. So that's one I would suggest that you're going to have to either do a little bit of research or contact someone and have them do some research on your behalf to get to the right answer.
Okay.
All right.
Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for the call. We were talking earlier a little bit about income tax rates. I wanted to get into some more detail about this. How could they change starting next year?
The current tax rate system that we have has a lowest rate of 10% on income, basically up to $17,400 of taxable income, and a maximum rate of 35% on income over $388,350. Now, first, let's explain how our tax rates work. We have a graduated rate system, and that means that as your income goes up, each bracket or each group of income will be subject to a progressively higher rate of tax. So currently, a joint taxpayer would pay 10% tax on the first $17,400, and then the range of income between $17,400 up to $70,700 would be subject to a 15% rate of tax, and so on. And so you have this ladder or stair-step effect. Well, what will happen if Congress takes no action is the lowest rate of tax on every taxpayer will increase from 10% to 15%, and the maximum rate of tax on high-income taxpayers, those in excess of that $388,350 number, would go up to 39.6%. Now, the argument that's going on in Congress right now is that I think everyone, Republicans and Democrats, have now come to some agreement that the very high-income taxpayers should pay a higher rate of tax. The problem is that if they take no action, these changes are going to occur. And to give you an example of how this would affect lower and middle income people, someone with taxable income in the $59,000 up to about the $70,000 range, the marginal rate of tax on that income would go from 15% to 28%. Now, that's almost double. I mean, 13 percentage point increase going from 15 to 28. So it clearly, if Congress takes no action, every taxpayer is going to pay a higher rate of tax on their income. And this is the concern that exists right now. And this is, among other things, it's part of what's called the so-called fiscal cliff. There's a lot of folks out there who are a lot smarter than John and I who believe that this would be a very, very bad thing for any economic recovery that's going on, because taxpayers suddenly are going to have a lot less disposable income. And in addition to these tax rates going up, things like tax credits for having children. There is a child tax credit that is currently $1,000 per child that would go to $500. There are credits for dependent care that would be reduced significantly. There are deductions and credits for education incentives that would go away. There are lots and lots of things that have been put into the tax law. It's interesting. Congress uses tax law to encourage certain types of behavior. One reason they lower tax rates is so that people have more disposable income, so they'll go out and spend money, buy cars, buy clothes, and stimulate the economy. And over the years, a lot of these things have been put into the tax code to encourage these behaviors that are desirable behaviors. And now something that has taken years and years to get to, all of these things occurred over a long period of time. Well, they're going to pull the rug out from all of those on one day, December 31st at midnight. And there's a significant concern about the impact that might have on the economy, because there's just no question that the amount of disposable income that's in the hands of taxpayers will go down as of the first of the year if nothing happens. And that's this fiscal cliff that they're referring to.
John, what is the alternative minimum tax, and what do we need to know about that?
Well, the interesting thing about alternative minimum tax, which we normally refer to as AMT, and you read a lot of articles about AMT, which is what that is, it's really, you know, a very difficult concept, I think, for most people to grasp. What it really is a parallel tax system to our regular tax rates. And so what happens is, for regular tax, there are certain things that you can deduct, like your property taxes, your withholding on your wages, you know, those type of items that for alternative minimum tax purposes are not allowed. And so what you have to do is you have to calculate your regular tax with the normal deductions that you already claim. And then there's a form 6251 that you fill out to basically add back certain items into that calculation. And the issue that we have right now with AMT,
and then you pay the tax the higher of the two.
Yeah, you pay the higher.
You calculate it both ways, pay the higher of the two.
Yeah. Okay. And so the issue that we have right now is, right now for a married person, the AMT exemption is somewhere around $70,000.
Yeah, about 75.
Yeah. Yep. And so what happens is, if this fiscal cliff happens where we go back to the old rates, it's closer to $45,000. And so an article that I just read yesterday, interestingly, you know, talks about this, and it basically says that 100 million taxpayers could be impacted by this out of a total of $150 million expected to file. So that's two-thirds of people who are filing based on this article that I read yesterday, that's kind of summarizing this. So it really is a big deal to have that extra exemption amount, because what's going to happen is more people will now be subject to a higher tax rate as a result, because the AMT is going to pull them back in.
What's been interesting about the AMT is that this exemption amount, the reason it's a problem is the exemption amount at roughly $45,000 was put in many years ago, and it's never been indexed for inflation. Unlike many other things in the tax code where they adjust for inflation, they never have. And what's happened each year for the last, 10 probably, is that Congress has, at the end of every year, they pass what they call an AMT patch, just a one-year temporary increase in the exemption amount. It's currently 75 or 75.5, and I think for this year it would be projected to be about a $79,000 exemption amount. Well, Congress has said that they aren't really interested in passing another one-year AMT patch. They want this to be part of the overall tax bill. And so something that has universally been extended for probably the last decade is now caught up in this whole fiscal cliff negotiation. And there are a number of examples of things like that where Congress has routinely extended these relief provisions, and now everybody's drawing a line in the sand and saying, we're not going to keep throwing a Band-Aid on it. We want it to be part of an overall fix. And as John said in this one particular article from a tax service that we get, as many as two-thirds of the taxpayers in this country could end up being subjected to additional tax under the alternative minimum tax. And the numbers aren't necessarily small. I did a projection last week for a client that if they extend the exemption increase, as they have for the last decade, they would have a $1,200 refund. If they do not extend that and the exemption amount reverts back to the $45,000 amount, they will owe $7,000. So it's an $8,200 increase for this one particular taxpayer. Now, many people will be far smaller numbers than that, but it's a tax that will be imposed on hundreds and millions of taxpayers that have never been subjected to that before.
Well, that said, some of what we're talking about, if I understand it correctly, involves what's commonly referred to as the Bush-era tax cuts.
That's right.
And while we could say, yes, they were renewed year after year for 10 years, when they were initially presented, it was an idea of a temporary tax cut.
That's right.
Because we were dealing with a budget surplus at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a surplus anymore. That's
right.
So it's, in some ways, you can look at it and say, well, this is going to be a dramatic switch. But maybe it's a dramatic switch that some would characterize that should have been phased in over the last several years.
And that is that's why it's called the cliff, because we're literally standing at the precipice ready as opposed to slowly climbing down from the edge. We are now at the edge ready to be pushed or jump over, and it's a long way to the bottom. And the reason for the tax cuts originally were because we had the surpluses, but now we're not in that position. Clearly there needs to be something done, and I'm not going to get into all the discussion about how we got there, why we got there, what needs to be done, but there needs to be a coming together of revenue and expense. The problem is, with the economy being fairly fragile, there are a lot of very, very smart economists who say now is a really bad time to raise taxes on everyone. Yeah. And I think that's universally accepted, that most people would agree that raising taxes across the board would be a very bad idea for a lot of reasons. Now we just have to, the folks in Washington have to decide what's that threshold? Can we agree on something?
John, do you recall this much uncertainty before heading into the end of a calendar year about what the next year's tax structure may look like?
No. I mean, I've been doing this for over 30 years, and I don't ever recall this much uncertainty. I mean, we've had issues, before, a couple of years ago, for example, with the estate law, where basically there was the sunset provision that said, okay, if you die in 2010, you have an unlimited exclusion on your estate, which now is $5 million. And at the time, I thought, well, this will never happen. Well, I got out of the business of predicting after that, because, obviously it did. And then we had an issue in 2010 where, you could make it retroactive. You could elect to follow the You know, there's an unlimited exclusion here. So, you know, that's the most recent one that I can think of, but it pales in comparison to what we're looking at this year.
And I think the other distinction I would make is this: the uncertainty we're facing affects everyone. It's not something that applies. The estate rules really only apply to the wealthy taxpayers. These provisions, if things don't get resolved in Washington, everyone is going to be looking at changes.
And on that lovely note, happy holidays, everyone. Marty Verdick is a partner and certified public accountant with McLadry LLP in Champaign. John Breen is the tax director at McLadry. Marty, John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us. We really enjoy it.
We welcome any additional thoughts you may have about today's program on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. Remember, you can hear this program twice a day, live weekday mornings at 10, then rebroadcast weeknights at 8 on AM 580. And if you know anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus but lives outside of our listening area, let them know we stream the program live every day at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen back anytime to past programs. Focus is also available as a free downloadable podcast. To sign up, again, visit the Focus page of our website. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. On Monday and Tuesday of next week, Focus will give way for some special holiday programs. On Monday at 10 a.m., you can join us for a program called The Great American Songbook Holiday Special 2012. And at 8 o'clock Monday night, when you would normally hear a rebroadcast of Focus, we will present Tinsel Tales, NPR Christmas Favorites. Then on Christmas Day, Tuesday at 10 a.m., we will present Roll Credits, A Hollywood Holiday. Then it is back to the regular schedule with some encore broadcasts of Focus interviews Wednesday through Friday of next week. We will listen back to conversations about the life of Julia Child, the writings of J.R.R. Tolkien, and a fascinating conversation with journalist and undocumented immigrant Jose Antonio Vargas. Finally, we'll close out 2012 on Monday, December 31st, with a special edition of Focus presenting Illinois Public Media News Top 10 Stories of 2012. Today's show is produced by Travis Stansel. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey, Kimberly Cronick, and Jim Meadows. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks so much for joining us.